Hey everybody, this is Pete Worrell from Bigelow, and I want to welcome you to this episode of the Positive Enterprise Value Podcast. This is a podcast where I get a chance to interview some of the most amazing and interesting entrepreneur, owner, managers on the planet, and we deconstruct some of their journey to disrupting their industry, to being a game changer in their industries, to really potentially gathering a capital gain and using the liquidity from that to fuel the next chapters of their lives. Today I have the fun of interviewing Bill Perkins. Bill is a well-known energy trader who graduated from the University of Iowa, I think it is, as an electrical engineer, but quickly went into the Merck, became an energy trader. Over that period of time, the following 10 to 15 years, he viewed the world around him, and some of his views of the world are reflected in his book, one of which is called Die with Zero, which is a book that I love. I hate the title because the title is so limiting, because the book is so much better than just Die with Zero. My friend Ed Wilson humorously suggested that the book be titled Die with Zero Regrets. Bill was the featured speaker at the 2024 Bigelow Forum, where we pulled in about 100 entrepreneur owner managers and their spouses from across the country to think about some of the themes in Die with Zero, to kind of challenge us. Some of the themes had to do with, for example, as you accumulate value in your life, the question why. Are you oversaving? When do you share some of this with your philanthropic causes or with your children? Are you trying to be your own insurance company by saving for your mortality or saving for your longevity? So Bill was extremely provocative with the Bigelow Forum. He's the only person I know who can fit more F-bombs into one sentence than I can. So he really made me feel much less guilty about my salty language. Take that, Bigelow team. And we had a great time at the forum, both hearing his talk to us for about an hour, as well as the live podcast interview, which we did just after his talk, which really is a series of questions from the audience, which I know you're going to love. Without any further ado, I hope you enjoy Bill Perkins as much as I do.
Woo! Welcome back. So the plan is, subject to your input, because we're here for you, is that Bill and I will do a little interview. We're recording this for our podcast called Positive Enterprise Value, and we'll drop this when Marissa decides in a couple of weeks. I'd love it if actually our interview wasn't so much me asking questions of Bill, but you asking questions of Bill. And then we'll work in a bunch of his scholarship from the book into it if you want to, and we'll work into some of your stories of like how what we've been talking about applies to you, your families, your communities, your enterprise. So I really mean it. Like, I guess I can call on you. Jeannie, you look like you have a question, but rather decide, like, have you do it, okay? And we're going to do this for maybe about 45 minutes. And then Bill has generously agreed to sign some books if you'd like to. And we'll have a quick break and we'll go to our cocktail party at the pool. You cool? So the first thing I'd like to say is thank you, but not for what you think. Thank you because I've actually never heard anyone drop more F-bombs than I do. And so I feel so much less guilty about that now. I really, really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Take that.
Yeah.
Bill, many people know you as an author or a thought leader or an energy trader or as a dad or a husband. But if you were going to describe to maybe your 20-year-old daughter what you do professionally, what kind of nouns would you use to describe that today?
Oh, wow. I you know, it's funny. I just recently had a conversation with my daughter, and I told her this is an amalgamation between a conversation between my daughter Sky and Brisa. And essentially, I said, listen, I'm just a guy winging life just like everybody else, right? And I'm just trying to do my best and find out what fulfills me. And so And part of this conversation was like, look, you don't have to be anything. You know, there's a lot of pressure on them, and I was just telling them that all you have to do is do your best. Just do your best. You'll have, you know, all my regrets are associated with periods I didn't do my best, whether that be in an emotional relationship, a job, a project I was working on, etc. The regret, when I do my best, there's no regret. I did my fucking best. Like, what else could I have done? But when I don't do my best, that's where the regret creeps in. And that could be I didn't do my best and I was on autopilot and just let my fucking 20s go there. Or, you know, I didn't do my best in this relationship. I allowed anger. I didn't seek out the counsel or the wisdom or read the book or do the thing, right? And so my job is to do my best and according to my values and raise them. And so that's my job. Now, if you're saying professionally, if you really want to narrow it, like professionally, is that I'm an entrepreneur. You know, what I do is I find missions that enable people to have other people to have jobs and to have an impact on the world.
Is that what you thought you were going to do when you were a kid?
I really wanted to be I wanted to be an astronaut when I was a kid. My mom, when I was 9, gave me this book called The Right Stuff. I read it. I fell in love with it. And I thought this like romantic idea of being a scientist, astronaut, was fantastic. That's what I thought I would be doing. But like, you know, the path of, you know, what you want now, like life is discovery. And I say this often, you don't know what you want, you discover what you fucking want. Another F-bomb for you.
All right. Thank you.
You come out, you know, I want to be a firefighter, you know, I want to be a model, I want to be an actor, I want to be whatever. You don't come out of the womb knowing you like onions or hate onions or like this or et cetera. You go in the world, you have this organic spacesuit, right, that is fueled on carrots and carbohydrates and proteins that allows you to walk through space-time and explore. And as you explore, you discover the things about the world around you, and you discover what you like and what you want at those time periods. And so saying, you know, having lived, you know, 70% of my life, I can go to my kids and tell them from other people's experiences is that you don't have to know what you want right now. You don't even have to know. You're going to discover it, right? The things you want now, maybe you'll continue to do them. Maybe that'll take you on a path to another discovery, but life is discovery, and that's what it's about. And so what you do, what you specialize, what gets you going, what you're passionate about, what foods you like, what culture you adopt, et cetera, this will be discovery. And so, you know, here's to a life of discovery. And my role is to give them the basic tools so that they can navigate life and go on discovery in any type of situation and be kind, compassionate, capable young women.
Howard, do you have a question for Bill?
Question. How much do you take into account is what you're doing enriching to your life? It might be economically enriching, but is it enriching your values? Because where does conflict come into your economic well-being, to your moral well-being? So somebody might be doing something and earning a lot of money, but is it valuable to their world? Even if they take that money and do valuable things with it.
Yeah, so I have a belief, by and large, and at least the things that I've been doing, but like a super, super, super majority, that the value that accrues to you is a fraction of the value that you create to the world. And so even if I'm doing something like, steel making, I'm a steel baron, right? That steel, that value is something that society values and does well. And so, you know, I have... maybe 200 people who are putting their kids through school, et cetera, because of the missions that I'm on. Later on, aside from just making the money and that the society values and I'm getting a fraction of it and all the people in the organization are getting a fraction of the value provide, there are specific mission statements that I just want to do. Like my ikigai, right? Like what fulfills me, what I'm good at, what I can make money at, and what the world needs, right? Those four things came together. And that was SkyFi and SynMax. And so the goal of SynMax, that company is a giant Rube Goldberg machine to have a significant impact on illegal underreported fishing, right? Illegal fishing and underreported fishing, and unregulated fishing. So if the, you know, if the ocean dies, we all die. You can sink a whole country into the ocean. You can drop a nuclear bomb. We've exploded nuclear bombs lots of places. As long as it's not global thermonuclear war, we'll be fine. You can even raise the planet 4 degrees. Yeah, people will die, but not all of us die. But if the ocean dies, we all die. And so I think, you know, having an impact on illegal fishing is kind of like the North Star for that company, right? And I also believe in SkyFi, one of the last unhacks, the value of information is, you know, with Google, et cetera, has had enormous benefits upon society, medicine, every single area. And one of the last data unhacks is what's happening above us and Earth observation. And so I'm not going to be, you know, I use the analogy, it's like I'm not going to be the doctor to save your life, but I'm going to be the guy who's going to make MRIs cheap and efficient, right? So I'm not going to be the genius who takes that data from space and does all the wonderful things and stops, you know, forest fires or bridges from collapsing early, et cetera, but I'm going to make it easily accessible and a user experience that you're able to do with it. And so long, long, long answer to say that, you know, I'm a cog in a wheel, and as long as my values are true and I'm providing value to society, then we're all aligned.
Bill, you've said a couple of times very nicely today that you weren't making qualitative judgments on things. We all appreciate that, but I'm going to ask you to make one. So last night at a pre-dinner, we talked a little bit about some of the themes in the book. And anyone who would like to chime in here, I can't find, there's Chad. If you want to chime in, please do. What about the kids? So you've got some views on that, about what about the kids? You just made them clear to us. Would you be in favor of, for example, making some policy changes in our country so that that favors your point of view? So an example would be have 100% estate tax on over a certain amount of wealth?
Wow. So incentives work, right? Like if it was 100% estate tax.
Over a certain amount. So in other words, my setup would be maybe someone has wealth and they give it away during their lifetime, and maybe you want, including to their kids, but maybe you want to have some left over, 5 or 10 million. I'd say, okay, keep that. But I'm asking the question, over that amount, why not enforce your idea with 100% estate tax?
I'm not in favor, you know, the government is not necessarily the best steward of your capital. I don't think they're the best allocator.
Really?
And their values often don't align with my values. You know, I have a
I guess the answer is no.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea. Like, the idea that, okay, if you don't spend it, we're going to take it, is great, because then people are like, shit, I'm going to spend it down before. You know, like, that's like a forcing, that's a maximum forcing, that's a lot of incentive. They already take 40% over 13.6 million, right? And so that's a forcing function. People are like, shit, I better spend it. And this is, so you got 13.6 to give your kids, and then the rest you better spend down, or, you know, it's going to get chop suey, and they're going to decide where it goes, 40% to the government, and whoever they decide to split up or people fight over without you planning it. I am not in favor, just generally as a libertarian, of government solutions.
Got it. Me neither. Go ahead. Jag, and then Howard. Jag, we're going to throw you a microphone. Just if you can just speak into that.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. So I also just read Paul Tice has a book on ESG investing, and is very critical of it. And we're starting to see some of the big investment firms moving away from it. I just don't know if you have any thoughts on that and impact of ESG on, let's say, things like inflation or affordability for the middle class. And
I think a lot of the ESG investing is a scam. It's the idea of looking good without actually doing good. A lot of policies are designed that way to, like, you know, lead with the appearance of doing good. So there's a thing I was talking to some other people, and one of the best lines I've ever heard for me giving advice, I went to this emotional intelligence class called Choice in the desert. It was the most impactful thing on my life ever. And a lot of my success subsequently that in relationships and both financial are because I went to that class. And I was getting coaching one time after the class, actually during it, and they were like, nobody cares what you know unless they know that you care. And I was like, They don't give a shit how smart you are, Bill Perkins, unless they know that you care. Just dealing with humans, because like I'm slightly on the autistic side, right? And so I really took that to heart, and I see that like in certain people hijack that, right? They lead with we care, but the policy or the actions behind it are actually hurting you, right? There are a lot of policies, government policies that like, oh, I'm going to vote for this guy. He cares. He says the right words that he shows he cares, but it's actually bullshit behind it, right? It's not really not effective, you know, ESG, right? And that's what happens when you have these systems sometimes is that they get gamed, right? And so do I believe that there's things that are out there valuable for the impact and policies and investing that can be done, but a lot of it's gaming, gaming the system, and really just another form of regulatory capture and enrichment, and not actually doing the thing.
Howard.
So I have a question, but I'm going to respond to what you just said first. I tell people that it's easy to remember your second grade teacher, but you don't remember almost anything she said, but you certainly remember how they made you feel. And the same is true for most people. They don't care how smart you are or what you said, but they'll remember for a long time how you make them feel. And I think a whole lot of what you're talking about is how you make yourself feel and how you make the people around you feel by choosing to spend your money, your time, your resources, optimizing what you want rather than what you're putting off. My question is if you're thinking about a dashboard or if you're thinking about KPIs, which makes sense, right? I mean, it's really hard to manage what you don't measure, and it's actually even more effective if you report what you measure and talk about it and think about it and use it to inform more actions. So what are some of the things that you would put on a KPI or memory dividend dashboard
for net fulfillment
for mine or for?
Well, you're talking to a room full of people who.
Well, I mean, like the book is agnostic. I'm not going to tell anybody how to live their life. Like your KPIs are going to be different from my KPIs, right? So I'm not here to virtue signal like this is should be your KPIs at all. Well, like so I stay away from that. If you want to know mine, I'll tell you some of mine.
Yeah. So I mean, I think in frameworks. I run an AI company. And so, like, I like categories, but I also like categories of time. So I think thinking about what would I want to do at least once a year? What would I want to do once a quarter? What would I want to do once a month?
Yeah,
what would I like to do once a week, once a day?
Yeah, that's great. Mine is, you know, the ones I look at is how much money did I spend on planes and hotels? Because that's a great indicator of how much travel that I've done. Right,
is
and
that
so
time away or time is it? Are you moving towards or moving away with that one?
No, I'm going on vacations and traveling. So if I have a plane bill of X dollars, right, I know I've done this much traveling. If I have a hotel bill of X travel, it's just a nice metric for me to measure like the things I like to do. Travel, I love yous. How many times did I have sex with my wife? You know, things like that. Like these things we know, and I don't need a dashboard. We know we're going at it, but maybe later in life I need to have an alarm bell. I have an alarm that goes off at 6 o'clock p.m. every day. It goes off at 6 p.m. every day to make sure that we've connected. If we're not together or we haven't connected, because I get busy, I'm doing things, I get sucked into the puzzles that I'm trying to solve in the world. And that alarm goes off for me and my wife to at least, you know, an hour, if we haven't been spending time, or 30 minutes or even 5 minutes just to connect, be like, I love you, et cetera. So that's kind of like a built-in daily KPI. I look at, we go over, what are my charitable contributions versus my earnings, right? On my value system, every single dollar that comes into my life, except for the stuff that I take out of the bank in cash and put in the cash so my staff doesn't know, is tracked. And so we look over it. We go over it at the end of the year. How much money did I make? How much money have I donated? What are the things that are apparent to me? And I make sure that gets trued up every year. How much money have I given to friends and family and people that are less fortunate than me? With the now, I think it's $18,000 exclusion per year, tax free every year. So, you know, one time that list was 40 people long. 18,000. How many times have I seen certain friends? How many parties have I thrown? I think it's a fundamental, humans are one of the few creatures that will get together to have fun and have a social, right? Like, just for the purpose of having fun. It's a quintessential human trait, and so I think we have a moral obligation to have fun and have parties. So I throw parties. I throw fucking ragers.
Ben, you look like...
So these are some of my KPIs, right? Like, but, you know, anybody can have KPIs. It could be like how many times they go to strip club. I don't care.
I'll just add one more thing. Sometimes people move towards, sometimes they move away. Yeah. I use a trick in a conversation with people, and I say, if you imagined a fishbowl filled with marbles, and you said each one of these marbles represents how many more wow trips I'll have in my life. And you think about, you know, you're a certain age, how many am I going to have? Or how many times am I going to really make soulful love with my wife? It's this many times per year or per month or per week for this many years. And you realize that there's a finite resource. And then you think about each time you do it, you take away, or each time the time period goes away, you take away, and you're missing opportunities. Some people respond to the moving away from as much as the moving towards.
I don't know. For me, in the book, there's an exercise called time bucketing, and it's basically dividing the years of your life until you die. So it could be, for me, it would be 55 to 60, 60 to maybe 65, and then 65 to 75, and then, you know, as a certainty, it gets wider. And it's like, what experiences do I want to have in there? And it could say it's your health, social, emotional, you know, it could be anything, right? And it's to give me a framework of like what belongs where and what are my goals, right? You know, like I want to go see my kids graduate, just go to marriage, you know, have a baby, travel here, go skiing, this many trips, etc. It's called time bucketing. So give me kind of like this framework that we visit and we change as we discover life. It's an iterative process. And so that kind of gets you, you know, myself, my wife off autopilot about like, hey, these are the phases of our life. Not only am I going to die at the end of my life, but these time periods die. And once they're gone, they're gone. And certain experiences either don't transfer well or don't transfer at all to the next time period in your life. And so, you know, I guess that's kind of like the marbles, you know, that concept of like these things, you know, I only have a certain amount of the things that I can do that are in my 55 to 60 bucket that will not transfer to the next bucket based on, you know, my capabilities or the people who are going to be around me.
Hi, I have a question. I really enjoyed your book. Thank you very much. And there were some key takeaways that made me look at things differently. Like, you're right. If we want to give money to our children, if we do, do it beforehand and just determine it. And I really appreciated that. Of course, I loved your St. Bart story too. But just to expand on giving the kids money, this is a room filled with entrepreneur-owned companies. The majority of our net worth, I can imagine, is tied up in an illiquid company, unless it's not really illiquid. Nothing's truly illiquid, right? So to gift in advance equity in a company that you're not sure what that company is going to be at a certain time is very confusing and hard. I know you're not giving financial advice, but it becomes ultimately a lot more timely for a lot of us because the amount we can give away is going to be maybe expiring the end of 2025. Are you following me on this?
Yeah.
So these are conversations that are very active right now with me, my husband, and a lot of friends that have businesses that it would be so great just to give it. Cash is easy, right? But sometimes that's if you're in a go-go mode and your company is growing, equity might not be doing them a favor. It comes with baggage. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I have an estate planning attorney. You know, there's things called GRATs, grant and annuity trusts, defective grant and annuity trusts, trading things out, them paying you back, et cetera. And some people have, speaking of equity, like some people did a GRAT, right? Do most people here know what a GRAT is, a grant and annuity trust? This is a way that if you essentially you loan money to your kids, right, and at certain rate, it's a federal rate, and the appreciation of the asset after they pay you back is tax-free, right? And some people have done these things, and the thing, like, actually something blew up, and they have more money than they ever intended to give their kids, and the kids are actually richer than the parents now, right? And it was too much money. And sometimes there are things called failed grats, right? The grat fails, and it goes away, and it gets busted, and busted grats. I have that too, because I like my kids are actually, I was like looking at a tap. Oh, they're the largest shareholders there, and goes back. But this is something, there's ninjas in this field who are well-versed in this, on giving them, getting it in, if it has liquidity, swapping it out, defector annuity trust. Like, there's this whole damn world, right? And so my job isn't to, like, understand that world. My job is to hire the people that do, so that I can address this issue, right, that you're talking about. And so while I can't, you know, talk about the liquidity provisions, is this the right asset to transfer into them? And if it goes bust in a GRAC, could I take it back, et cetera? I know that that exists. Those ninjas exist. And then I would just suggest that you get those ninjas on your team, right? Because other people have had this problem for years and years. The tax code is super complex, and there is literally specialists. This is all they do. And so I would, as I have, you know, I have those ninjas working for me.
Yeah, I took your question slightly differently, Carrie. I agree with what Bill just said, but I think there's a difference between if you think you're going to own your private business for the foreseeable future or in perpetuity, gifting your kids some ownership of the business is kind of interesting because it implies some things for them. Sometimes it implies a say in the business. Maybe not today, but maybe in the future when they're older. Sometimes it implies a role, R-O-L-E, in the business. And so I think if you are thinking about this question, forgive me, this is not an answer, it's another question. But if you think about this question, my question would be, do you have a capital gain transaction in mind? Because if so, I agree with Bill, there are ninjas whom we know and you know who can figure out how to get some of that stock to your kids so that the appreciation from a transaction is out of your estate. But that's different to me than not having that capital gain transaction on the horizon and saying, I'm going to take care of my kids.
What I would do is I would take debt out and give it to the kids.
So you take, in effect.
I would take debt. I mean, if you're just like, oh, I'm going to manage this and this is what I'm going to do, I'm going to take debt.
No, you take cash.
Yeah, I debt, whatever. Right, I take debt on the business, cash. Take the cash,
yeah.
Pick it to the kids, right? And so.
Don?
I've got a two-part question. First is silly and the second is serious. Do you recall the notorious skinflint, tightwad Jack Benny in the 1950s? He was a comic, and he had a riff that went like, well, he gets held up by a mugger in a back alley, and the mugger says, not questioning, it's more of a demand, your money or your life. No answer. He says, your money or your life. Jack responds, hold on, I'm thinking. So I'm wondering, that sort of encapsulates your theory here. Do you, what do you expect will be your memory dividend, your payback for this day that you're spending with us today? Do you consider this work or play? And when you look back, where are you going to put it on your ledger?
So I like that question. Let's start back to why I agreed to come. So originally, I didn't write the book. Like, you don't write books to make money. I just wrote the book that it could save my life. And, you know, if you read the book, Dr. Renner was like, you have to write this down. And I was like, yeah, if I get this in order, I have my little diary here that I can go back to. Just kind of like the book, The Four Agreements. I go to that book, back to that book, like, every 2 years, right? Every 2-3 years, I'll read the Four Agreements, or at least one of the agreements, like, yeah, I fucked up here. I should have stayed on agreements. And so I don't want to be the guy. Like, some people write books like Susie Orman or whatever, and they're the guy, right? I'm not the guy. I wish there was somebody else who could be, like, the guy for me, like my Peter or my Paul, the Church of Die with Zero. But, you know, my wife and I were like, there's all these requests, podcasts, no more podcasts, unless, you know, my family is away and I'm doing nothing but twiddling my thumbs, then I view it as service, as going on the podcast. Like, it's saving my life. You know, when I was a kid, you know, your fantasy is the girls, right? What's your number one fantasy? It'd be something sexual, right? And my number one horror would be to accidentally take a life, right? Now that I'm older, my number one fantasy is to save a life, and my number one horror is to accidentally take a life. And so I believe that I'm living out my fantasy when, you know, I'm in service and somebody takes a principle of this and they have a more enriching life, a more fulfilling life, as we talked about earlier. And so if those can align, we're like, wait a minute, she's never been to New Hampshire. We can go drive around. It's beautiful. I grew up on the East Coast, driving up here. There's this thing that has to happen. We're going to tie it all together, and I get to do all these things, right? Like, I get to be in service and do whatever, et cetera, and you guys wanted me here. Fine, it all came together. Unfortunately, we have to go back because of a health thing in our family, but the way I look at it now, and I might look at it differently, is that I am in service of my fantasy of saving life, and I'm having fun. And this was a new format with the clicker. Usually I just blather. So I'm having a great time, and I get to help you people. Whether you take one little bit of another, you're just going to have a more efficient, optimized life for net fulfillment, and that's great for me.
I don't know if Bigelow people are allowed to ask questions, but I have one for you.
Gotcha.
There was a Wall Street Journal article a week or two ago about younger generations drastically delaying having children until they find that they feel they're in financial stability. I'm curious, if someone gave you your book when you were that 22-year-old bench-riding football player, would you have changed when you had children?
I actually probably would have had children earlier. Than I did. I started at like 33, and I was in a panic. But I think my whole mentality would be different. But I would look at the time periods of my life, right? And when, you know, what age did I want to have my kids? You know, I was very autopilot still, even though I was thinking about these things, et cetera. I probably would have had kids earlier. It is something interesting now that, like, the culture has changed, the society has changed. When I was 30, my cohort, 70% of the people were married. If you walked out into a bar, 70% of the people were married. Now, in the current 30s cohort, 30% of the people are married. So that's a massive, massive shift, right? And 30, reason why 30 is the number is because that's the peak. It never, in history, it never goes higher than how many people are married at 30, and that's probably rooted in biology, et cetera. And so... just on a little bit of a tangent, I find that fascinating because basically you've doubled the number of people looking for housing and apartments, right? It's just crazy, right? Like you have 40% more people looking for apartments, right? Like, so, you know, this whole society and housing and the markets is built on cohabitation, right? And now you have a bunch of singles roaming around, right? And so they need a bed, and this person needs a bed, right? So I think that's interesting. Phenomena, but that's all I got to say. Todd?
Yeah, first of all, thank you for the book. I think it's a great manual. It's interesting. I kind of live that way. I figured I'd go to school for 20-something years, work for 20, and then play for 20. And if I live longer, fantastic, right? But my question comes is my mother's completely the opposite. She's always scared for the next day there's a car accident. We need this big savings for something that's going to happen. There's always this Black Tuesday or something coming. And I see my brother facing the same thing. He wants to save every penny, wants to be very careful for something coming. Have you run into, or how have you explained your theory? Because I've tried to be like, you got to enjoy some too before you forget and it's gone, or you can't do it, is the way you were putting it with health, I guess. Have you ever gotten through to someone that just sees it completely different?
I've had a lot of conversations on it, and there's a small part in the book about, like, you're not the best insurance agent. So, like, there's some people that have this, like, fear-based, like, I need to save money for these things, right? And essentially what they're saying is, I am going to self-insure for these things, right? And I'm like, well, you're not an actuary. You don't even know the odds. You don't even know the proper amount to save. Are you putting that money in the market? Like, it's just absolutely absurd, right? And so, you know, part of the conversation I have with people when I've gone down this is like, okay, what are the odds of this happening? What is the event? And do you even have enough money to save for that event? Like, really? Like, you save $50,000, you think that's going to cover this event? Let's take that one off. You're just going to get wiped out, so you might as well spend it, right? So there's a lot, right? No, seriously, like, there's a lot of events Like, you cannot fucking save for it. You just don't have enough money, right? And some of them you do. And then the other thing is like, you're inefficient. The 8%, the net gross, the 8% that these insurance companies have, pay them. They're way more efficient than you wasting your life. And so, you know, if you go into these fields where there's these ninjas in insurance, right, like, and you have, like, you know, just pay an attorney to read the thing, you can insure a lot of events, right? They'll insure people for their legs, their look, whatever. Lloyd's will insure this. Like, if you're worried about all these events, get an insurance policy where there's a professional who will do it for you at less waste than you wasting your life, right? And so I'm like, I if you have a fear, like, if I can't convince you that this fear is irrational, then I'll be like, all right, let's at least efficiently insure it away. Because you, with a client of one, not being an actuary, can't even do long division, right? it's not the best insurance agent. And so I have gotten through to people to like, hey, go insure this away. And now you can be free to go live your life as you want to go live your life.
It sounds overly simplistic, but just personally, when I read your book, I realized that for all my professional life, I had been insuring against mortality risk. And I discovered that I didn't need to insure against mortality risk. What I really thought about now was longevity risk.
Right.
Right. And that caused me to really rethink my balance sheet.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, mortality risk is all about paying taxes. It's a tax arb.
Yeah.
Right. Just there to cover some of the state taxes that are free or whatever.
So Chad, we were out talking last night. David, Lisa, we were talking last night. Do you want to chime into this discussion?
So one of the things I tell you, I said in the beginning, I'll just repeat it again. If you have the courage to ask a question, I promise I will answer voluntarily.
And Leon, did you have your hand up? I couldn't tell if you have your hand up if you were. Yeah. Leon, I can't hardly.
He does now. I do now. It's kind of the book very much resonates. There's two things that were kind of interesting. One is, I think when you have a health scare, kind of changes that pendulum back and forth. But the other interesting thing is, a lot of us are older or more mature in this room. So it's trying to, the messages resonate to help the kids younger, obviously to have babies. I'm teasing, but the whole thing is helping your kids when they were younger. So they, is how can you get the, is your message resonating or these type of, the buyers of your book, also the 30-year-olds?
Yeah, I mean.
5-year-olds versus someone like us, we got a message from the book. I think there's a message for getting that generation to read your book.
So one of my favorite talks was at UNC Chapel Hill. I got invited by an economics professor to come speak. The book was on the syllabus. And so, you know, UNC Chapel Hill, I could have never gotten into that college. But to have the economics professor invite me to go speak to these kids about, you know, full life cycle hypothesis and how, you know, if the class was, what was the class, Baxter? Economics and applied economics and happiness or something like that, or life applied. Anyway, it was awesome. And, you know, the book is a mental model for all ages above adult. And, you know, they are at the cohort that has the potential for the maximum amount of waste. And so the book is going to have, by definition, it should on average have the most impact on them. For them to be thinking about the total arc of their life, what experiences go when, you know, how do they balance their life, how do they have the maximum fulfillment out of that period. It was quite surreal. A couple months later, he goes, here, I thought you might enjoy this, and he sent all these papers written, and they're like, Perkins, page 67, he says, you know, in my book, like, shit, I'm being quite, cited and quoted by kids that, you know, in my cohort, like, I would never got it, right? So, yeah, I do think it has a big impact on the younger generation, and just mathematically, it should have the most impact.
So thinking through realizing a capital gain event, you know, you're 55, I'm 45. And one of the things that stuck with me in the book, and you showed the graph in your presentation slide, was realizing peak wealth, like in your early 50s, and really spending down what you've accumulated in terms of financial wealth. And where my head goes is, like, is the incremental benefit of having a travel budget of X number of dollars versus X number of dollars, if it's astronomically more than whatever you would envision for an experiential budget for yourself, like if you were to do a 5-year look back, you know, Bill Perkins, age 50 to Bill Perkins, age 55, have you realized a significant rise in fulfillment with the increased investments you've been making in experiences?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, my Lara and I, you know, she's been with me during this period. And so, like, each experience, and we know that we're coming to an end of a certain type of trip or a certain type of activity. And so, you know, we, whenever we can, trying to balance, you never get it perfectly right. You know, each one is amazing in life's fulfillment. And, like, I now actively use technology, whether it be, like, Google Photos bringing up this day. Lara creates a jar. She have a jar by my bed that I take out. It might be a memory or a note or an I love you that I, you know, savor. Those things give me a metric F-ton. Won't give you another F-bomb. Of fulfillment and enjoyment. But those types of trips are going to shift. Right. And, you know, it's really like making sure, not like just jamming them in, but like the things we want to do, we get done in the time period that we can get done. Right. Like for us, we want to have another kid. And we were talking about the timing of that. And we're like, OK, this is the last summer of chaos. Right. Because anybody who has kids, there's nothing that cramps your style than adding in the little teeny humans. Right. And so, we're like making sure we optimize for that period. And so we're quote unquote lighting money on fire on the experiences we want to have, because there will be no lighting money on those type of experiences in the future. They'll be different. They'll be wonderful, but they're there. And so I, for each experience that I have, they've led to other experiences. They led to discussion about them. They led to wonderful experiences. And it connects us more and more, right? Like having shared experiences together. You know, that's why you don't go to the movies alone, right? You want to experience it with somebody you love or a friend or et cetera. Like most people don't go to the movies alone unless you're a critic or a psychopath. No, I'm just kidding. But and so I've gotten max value. But that's just me. Maybe somebody else doesn't get that value. Maybe it would have been like hikes, you know, walking in parks. A lot of these experiences, like, you know, some of them aren't money. You know, some of them are just a hike in a park, a nice walk. You know, around the block, taking a dog together.
Ben, Dave, then David. Yeah.
Thank you, Bill. I'm glad you had a friend that challenged you on talking about health more in the book and how to expand health and health span and use that to be able to enjoy these experiences more. And curious, as you've worked with Peter, and just other health philosophies that you've kind of embedded into your life to can be able to enjoy experiences longer. And so even if it's a little tactical, some of the philosophies around health that you've really embedded and latched onto.
Yeah, so like everything, you know, the funny thing, I was talking to my friend Sanjay, and we're talking about what's the low-hanging fruit left that we can do for our health, like longevity and health-wise, right? And one of them was, it was funny because I always thought it was kind of douchey at first, but it was like, he's like, get a driver. Like the odds of you dying in a car accident, distracted, et cetera, is huge. Right? So if you get a driver who's a professional, they're not drinking, they're going the speed limit or no more than 5 miles per hour over it, et cetera, is going to significantly change your odds of dying. That's part of your health, right? The behavior design, there's a book called Tiny Habits by BJ Fogg, and I actually took his boot camp. But designing for health. So if I have to go to the gym and drive or whatever, there's a level of difficulty. And basically behavior design is the easier something is to do, the more likely it will get done. And so my Pelotons are right upstairs. I got no fucking excuse, right? I got no excuse. One of the life hacks I had is hiring a chef, right? So much of it is what you put in your body. So not only is a chef like everybody thinks, oh, fancy, convenience. No, my carbs, proteins, or fats are broken down by each meal. Perfect, right? And it's made together in a way that I want to eat it. So I don't have to think, I don't have the neural capacity to like, oh, do I eat this and this calories, whatever? It's done. My snacks, they're done. If I go to a restaurant, they'll call the chef up ahead. They'll call the restaurant. This is what you should eat. These are the things you can pick out, et cetera, right? So those are some of the other hacks, right? So, and then the rest are just like actually listening to what Peter Attia says to do, like getting your VO2 max, behavior designing the workout, hiring a trainer, having somebody accountable, right? Like if you have a problem setting those habits, it's worth paying a lot of money to enforcing those habits or having somebody on top of you, even if you're spending money, right? Because there's nothing more impactful to the net present value of your fulfillment from today to the day you die than these changes in your health. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Dave. Right?
So my question, I'm going back to your comment about, you know, giving your kids the money between 28 and 33, I think you said. And so, and then I'm tying it in with somebody else's question about business and stuff. So it's easy if you have, you know, you say, okay, my kid, they need a house, they need help with childcare, and they need to take a vacation. So that's $3 million. I'm going to gift them $3 million. But it's very different if you have a business and you're doing estate planning and you give them stock, which doesn't really help them in the short term, but could give them $50 million down the road. And so how do you balance that? I think it's related to the previous question.
Yeah.
Which I didn't like you. I didn't think you answered. So I'm trying. I'm trying again.
I mean, like I'm not a financial advisor, but I would give them debt and options, and maybe you might have given them too much. Your problem of like trying to balance, like, well, maybe the stock is gonna be worth, you know, 50x in 5 years versus giving them cash right now. Then give them a note with a call option. And give them the cash or whatever. Like, there's tons of, like, whatever your mathematical problem is that you're trying to solve for, there's an expert out there who will give you the answer. But my point is that you're going to be deliberate. Like, I'm not giving them $3 million because I'm judging that they need a vacation, whatever. I have a certain amount that I'm going to give them. This is just me. And that's what I want to give them. Right? Somebody might want to give their kids $50 million, $20 million, $30 million, $10 million. Right? And then they do whatever they want with it. I'm not here to say buy a house. Maybe they want to go open up a club or whatever. I'm just here, this is what I want to give them, to give them the experiences that they want to have, not the experiences I want to have, but for them. And if you're like, hey, there's this kind of weird scenario where I think the stock is going to be worth X in 5 years, so I don't want to do this, then there's a structure around it. I've structured around so many damn things, and these guys are probably experts about structuring around things, and you can call in other kind of experts to structure around to give you the profile, the payout, the risk reward you want. And so I'm not the guy to tell you that. That's on you. Nobody's coming to save you. Nobody's coming to rescue you. You got to go find these people, employ them, and tell them the scenario that you want, and then go ahead and do it.
Jay.
Jay Jacobs. Bill, when you think about regrets in your life, do they lean more toward the things you've done or the things you haven't done?
Haven't done by far, with the exception of when I haven't done my best. And sometimes I haven't done, the haven't done my best is usually an interpersonal relationship where I've acted out of anger, right? And so that's usually something that I've done and I'm like, shit. Why did I say that? Why did I do that? Why did I behave that way? Right? But otherwise, it's things that I haven't done. I didn't take this trip. I didn't visit this person. I didn't have these experiences. I didn't read enough to my kids during this period. Right? Those are the haven't done's. So it's by far haven't done.
Hi.
Bob?
You had mentioned earlier you're talking about your health and you're gauging it, and you went to a place, I think you said, in Seattle that helped you.
Biograph. So there were a couple questions about health that people asked me in the hall. What does the VO stand for? That stands for velocity of oxygen max. They put you on a bike. They put this thing on your thing. You're like an animal. You ride on a bike or you jog on a treadmill. They have all kinds of devices to measure that. And so According to my doctor, Peter Attia Huberman, this is the number one all-cause mortality. This is the index, right? Because it incorporates a lot of things. And based on VO2 max with tons and tons of data, my guy's like the data type guy. He's always about the data. What does the data show? There's a nice little chart about this is where you'll be if you stay in this percentile and what you'll be able to do. And so you can make a decision. You know, where do you want to be? What are your goals? Do you want to be in this curve or do you want to be on this curve? And these are the activities that you'll be able to do as you go forward in your life. And so given that I stated my goals, they're like, you know, wake the F up, Bill Perkins. You're delusional. And so I'm in the process of waking the F up. Oh, and that's Biograph. Biograph.
Rep?
Biograph in Seattle. That's a my doctor sent me up there to do all these tests. It's a whole body MRI. It's just a whole, all the stuff, right? Like all the bells and whistles and sterols measurement, demosterol, cholesterol, all the lipids measurement, the full Boston Health Panel, you know, all the tests you can possibly get.
I would also say that Chad Belinsky and Kim Bergeron have generously put together an outline that includes some of that material of other providers of that. I'm not sure if this Biograph is on there, but Chad offered last night to send it to anybody who's interested. I found it incredibly helpful. Steve?
First of all, thanks for being here, Bill. This has been great. I've got too many takeaways that I'll have to prioritize and sort through, but good, really good stuff. I mean, we're all going to die, and maybe a bunch of us in the room might be afraid of that happening. What is your last couple of years in your plan? What does that look like?
I mean, I want to be a farmer and gardener, hang out with my kids and tell stories about the old times and watch my grandchildren. And, you know, that's it. Like, I don't have, like, something exciting. And, you know, we look at, like, the activities that I can do to the day I die. And so one of the things I discovered is I like training, and not training like working out, but like riding on a train. I went on the Orient Express, and I was like, I hate wearing a suit. That's fucking bullshit. There's going to be a bunch of strangers, and I don't want to hang out with strangers and blah, blah, blah. And then I was like, you know what? You got to force yourself to do things you normally wouldn't do. We went on this thing on the shorter version of it, and I effing loved it. Loved it. And it was amazing because you go through areas that you can't drive through. There's no roads. Can't fly over and see. It's the only way is on the train. And it was comfortable, and I could read, and the people were nice, and we had a great time. And I was just like, this is amazing. And then because I did that, we went on the 7 prefecture train in Tokyo, which took me 4 years to get on. 4 years, because it's the only train, it's the only one. 1% of Japanese that try and go and I'll get on it. Japanese are notoriously racist. They are the superior race, so I guess. And then we finally like rented out the whole train for Larry's birthday and went on and had the best time ever. Number one trip of my entire life. Used to be safari before that. And so that's one of the things I'll be doing. Is, you know, last 5 years of my life, you know, you'd be like, oh, he just, so unfortunate. He just went on a train ride last year, you know, last month, that type of thing. So stuff like that.
I have two last questions, unless anyone would like to slide one in. My penultimate question is, in this group of entrepreneur owner managers, there's a lot of high achieving people here. And there are a lot of people who have achieved, who've built a lot of enterprise value and wealth. And so high performance or superior achievement is common here. But what's not clear is that not all of them would describe themselves as highly fulfilled or content. Would you describe yourself as content?
I'm extremely happy. So when, we have a relationship coach. And one of the things that changed one of my idiot days to now is like, before I thought, like, if you had a coach or a therapist or whatever, something was wrong. Like, I'm not going to therapy. That's fucking crazy, my first relationship. And I was like, I was a fucking idiot. Like, anybody who's ever done anything great from basketball, business, or whatever has had a coach or mentor, right, from teachers. Like, if you want to be great at something, like Michael Jordan had a coach, Tiger Woods had a coach, these business people had a coach, you know. So I didn't want an average relationship. I want a great relationship, right? I wasn't put on this planet to be average, and neither were you. And so, you know, one of the things we do is we have a coach. Now I'm mature and not an idiot. And we were just having a conversation. It's like, how are you doing? I was like, I'm having the fucking time of my life. I am so happy. I am content. I am blessed. I am living in gratitude, right? And like, it's an hour conversation in my solo time. And like after 25 minutes, you know, it's kind of like I'm just thinking of things to complain about. Right. Which is good, though. You should, if you don't have any big issues, right, like you tweak the small ones. Right. And it's good to have a coach and a third party, because I have my biases. The way I'm raised in Jersey City, Jersey City stuck in me. Right. Jersey City, New Jersey. There's things, whatever, to go over and to optimize. Right. Like, because that's what they are. I'm optimizing for the best relationship I can have, not only with my wife, but with my kids, et cetera. And life happens. Right. There's other people. How do you react to them? And this is, you know. Stimulus comes in, and this is how to react, you know, coach me to react a different way, to be more productive, et cetera. And so I am ecstatic. I am fucking ecstatic. Like, I feel like I stole something. Like, I literally stole something. Like, I sometimes I'm like, Lara will be somewhere, I'm like, this is crazy. This is literally crazy. And I'll tell you another example of this. A couple years, was it 2 years ago, the helicopter? Baxter, we have this place in Austin, and there's a little spot where you can land a helicopter. And we were like, all right, you know, it saves time going back and forth to Houston. We got in this helicopter, and helicopters are dicey. And, of course, we're in the helicopter, and it does one of these things. And it's like, oh, shit, Baxter's in the back with the dog and Lara. They're crying. I'm, like, in mode, like, okay, let me help this guy find an emergency landing spot where we're going to go. And he's turning, and I'm thinking, oh, shit, don't clip these power lines. Comes in. Lands, and we're just like, okay, whatever, we're going to make it. We get out, and I was just like, And when I got out, they're distraught. They're fucked up. And I'm just like, if I died then, it would have been I'm on model. I'm pretty much on model. It's okay. It's been a good life. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And so I think that reaction afterwards, besides the, like, all right, let's fucking try and survive mode.
Good test.
And when I got out, I was like, you know what I mean? Like, if I died, you know, I'm not like, oh, shit, I wish I'd done this or that. Or I'm like, nope, I did it. So that, to me, that's kind of like a realness check. Am I just bullshitting you? You know, am I just saying I'm ecstatic? No, I was like, we're going to die. We could have died. And I was like, cool with it.
David Gould, last question.
Although my wife won't let me drive and fly in a helicopter anymore.
Not a piston helicopter.
So many people in this room have more resources than they need to live out the rest of their lives. Probably many of them have enough resources to help their children be more fulfilled or do whatever they want with to help their children. And probably enough resources to be very philanthropic as well. If you were in that position, and it sounds like perhaps you are as well, why don't you just stop doing what you're doing tomorrow and go to farm?
So that is so one of the things, I just recently had a friend who goes, for a guy who wrote a book, Die With Zero, you work more than anybody I know. You have all this shit going on. And so one of the things I've done is I fire myself. My favorite thing is to fire myself, right? So, like, I'll have an idea, I'll execute, and then I'm like, oh, shit, I'm not the CEO anymore. I fire myself. I outsource everything that isn't towards my fulfillment or where I'm necessary, not to be the tip of the spear. But why I don't stop is my mission now, the money is a byproduct of my mission, right? The money isn't the mission, it's a byproduct, and then I spend it, right, on all the other things, whether it be charitable things, like we gave a significant gift to DePelchin, because I'm a big, we are big supporters of foster care and adoption. I think, like, a lot of charities that exist down the pipe or because of kids not in loving homes, whether that be jail, prostitution, drugs, crime, et cetera. And so what I've been able to do with the use of technology is not be chained into an office and go in there. And through the skill of putting other more qualified people in a position that I normally would be doing, right? Like, I don't run a mom and pop, right? I'm not the guy. I can be the owner. I can be the driver of the vision, but that doesn't mean I have to be there. Why should I be there? This guy's 10 times better than me. This girl's 10 times better than me, right? And so I am quasi-retired. Like, Baxter, how many trips do you think we take a year? How many times are we on a plane flying around? it's half my life. Like, I'm living my dream. I'm in balance with what I want to do, right? And the money's getting spent, I can promise you. My CFO, like, a lot of people, like, they're accumulating. Like, she's always worried that I'm... You know, a lot of people on this side of the curve, I'm like, this side. Like, you're not going to die that soon. You know, you're spending way too much, right? And so I still got that, like, let's go, you know? Like, like when I say I throw a party, it's not a party. Like, it's a concert, right? We'll have three musical acts, astronomers come in. Like, we had just give you an example. I'm like, yeah, I believe it's fun to have a party. Like, okay, what does that mean? Like, what does that really mean? We'll have 100, 200 people over on our lawn. We'll bring in astronomers for the solar eclipse. We'll set those up. We have three musical acts. We have a tent. We have production. We have food. We have performers or whatever. Kids' PlayStation, ever. Like, I can spend it, you know? I can spend it. So I'm in balance. I'm actually, when I'm in balance, I'm like, wow, Bill went broke before he died. But whatever. Who cares? What was I going to do it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Will you join me in thanking
Bill? One last question. If,
oh my gosh,
big if, you were going to write another book.
Oh, jeez.
What would it be?
I've been asked to write more tactical. So a lot of my friends is like, this is great, but I want the 600-page version of this book. They wanted to go into more tactical things, like in the life hacks. But I think I would write a book more in, like, properly executing some of these things that I did, but I'm not going to do it. It'd be part two, like the execution manual. Like a lot of questions, like on the taxes, like I got to get my kids and I have this stock or whatever. But like there'd be a whole chapter on that. Like here's the experts, here's whatever and so on. So here's how do you optimize for your health. Like make sure you hike. Hike, you can actually get a memory dividend walking and talking and spending with a friend. So you actually have a exercise thing that you like doing instead of being in a gym you don't want to be in and getting in nature, talking with a friend, and you're getting in shape. So you're getting like a triple threat, like all these little hacks along the way, and the hacks that my friends have come back with. Well, this is what I do, and this is why I got a driver, and this is why I have a chef, and this is why I have X, right? For each wealth level, right? But no, my wife won't let me write a book.
Now will you join me in thanking?
Thanks.
Bill?
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thanks, wife.
I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. We believe that entrepreneur owner managers are the most powerful pro-social and pro-economic force on the planet. And it's for that reason that we dedicate our firm, Bigelow, to working exclusively with them. At Positive Enterprise Value, we freely share our learning so that you can absorb from the experiences of other private business owners with skin in the game, just like you. Bigelow is widely regarded as the M&A advisor that deals exclusively with high-performing entrepreneur owner managers. Our scrappy independent boutique firm only offers one service, that is to help build and someday capture enterprise value. You can find all of the episodes on this podcast on Bigelow's website, which is BigelowLLC.com.